knowing that when you do your monologues, you expound at great length about yourself and many different subjects. How uncomfortable is it to have to appear sometimes on TV shows like David Letterman, you know, where everything is so confined?
It's very hard. Whenever I go on the talk shows, David Letterman, Jay Leno, and most recently, Conan O'Brien, I'm used to talking and getting rolling for an hour and a half. And I really find my own rhythm, and I come into my own form that way. So when they ask me, they say, well, we're going to do 7 minutes, and they think that's a lot. I'm out and gone, and I think, what happened? Because also the questions are rehearsed ahead of time, and I always try to throw David Letterman a curveball, say that we haven't rehearsed. Or Jay Leno threw me a curveball last time, but sometimes that's spontaneous. But it's so quick, you say, well, what was that about? So it's a form that I don't know how to work in, but I like being forced into it, just as a variety. And I think that it's fine. It's not something that I want to do a lot of, because I think that my power and strength is in sitting in front of an audience and slowly developing the narrative with them until they're completely in it and we enter into the story together. And they're in that story and we go into another space, another like a frozen time. And that's part of why I don't move on stage. I found that sitting behind the desk centers the narrative. I'm very expressive with my hands and face and with my words. But if I don't move around, see, moving around creates time, because I'm in one place and then I'm in another. That's a measurement of time. But when I'm just sitting still, the audience really gets into the story with me, and then we have a kind of real focus.
Well, you write a monologue and you perform it many times, and I assume that it probably becomes almost a carved in stone type of experience. Since you're talking a lot about your life, does that result in a sort of emotional detachment from all these experiences eventually?
Yeah, it does. That's part of the cure of it. It starts out as processing my life by saying, hey, what happened? And I'm not telling things I haven't, say, tried out with Renee, my wife and director, or my therapist, or friends. For instance, I went out last night after the show, and I was telling recent stories. I had leftover energy in recent stories, and then I realized, well, that's the beginnings of a monologue. Not that I'm consciously putting it together, but I'm always telling a story and seeing how it works. But what it does, yes, in the case of Grey's Anatomy, I'm now more distant, but at the beginning, it starts in three forms. First, I'm just telling what I remember. Then we tape record it, and Renee and I work on it and reshape it dramatically. And then the third part, it becomes a dramatic monologue with laughs and tension and drama built into it. And it becomes not fixed in stone, because, for instance, now I'm dealing, this is a section about Nixon being in my doctor's office. Richard Nixon and me thinking he had a mask on, because my pupils were dilated. And the night I was performing, Richard Nixon died that day, and I had to rearrange the monologue to be more respectful, to fit it, to not make a joke of it. And I find that that's always interesting, that history keeps changing and it still reflects in the monologue. And that the monologue is an open form, whereas my novel, Impossible Vacation, is closed. There's no re-entering into that. And when I play the monologue, it can always change a little bit in relationship to the place I'm in, just in minor ways, and that makes it refreshing for me. The other thing about the monologue is I can play irony and can play many different things with my hands and voice at the same time I'm doing the narrative. And you can't do that in the printed. You know, you're absent for the printed, you're present. I like the presence. I think the form that I'm doing is very unique, because we're living in a world of virtual reality, where mainly what we experience is through television or the image, or it's brought to us through film. And people aren't used to a live performer, and I think that's a unique and wonderful experience. They're so used to seeing a film. The other thing is that they get into creating their own images in their head, because they have to, because I'm telling the story, and it's not just my image they're seeing. They're having their own personal interaction. And here we are, you know, talking like old days, like radio. See, I grew up with radio. We didn't have a television in our home till I was 11 years old. So I grew up with imagining Ozzie and Harriet's House, say, one of my favorite shows. I had it all in my mind. Then when television came, they put Ozzie and Harriet on TV, and you have the literalization of the image. You have the TV production's house. So I find that the spoken word stimulates the imagination. And in my case, the audience is there as a collective. So they're doing it together. So I don't ever felt it's a monologue or a solo. I feel like I'm dancing with the audience. And I'm riding their wave of energy and laughter. I'm getting through these shows here in L.A. for 1,400-seat house on their energy. They're uplifting me. If I was just in a room writing, I wouldn't be working off their energy.
You've presented your monologues not only in the U.S., but also in Europe and Australia, from what I understand. Is there a difference in the audiences?
Amazingly enough, not a great difference, although it's subtle. I have performed also in Scotland, Ireland, England. Ireland was wonderful because of the tradition. They really understand what I'm doing. It's just natural. The only strange experience I had on the road was Perth, Australia, which is the most isolated city in the world. And it's a nouveau-rich city, and they have no sense of irony yet. And my monologues are so filled with irony. I performed Swimming to Cambodia there in 1986, my monologue about the killing fields, being in the killing fields, and no one laughed. Every night I'd come back and say to Renee, I don't know what's going on. They're looking at me and taking everything I'm saying literally, seriously. And I think, the way they look at me, I think I have to go back into therapy. But I'd say Perth, Australia was that unique experience. Then you get into a place like Austin, Texas, and they're just so rowdy. They're more demonstrative. Or Santa Cruz, they'll yell out or whistle. And then in England, you have the other side. In London, the other extreme, although they're attentive. I was doing Swimming to Cambodia in England, and my agent at the time was there because she had an office in London. And she was laughing so hard at all the Hollywood stories, which are in the book of Swimming to Cambodia, not in the film. And someone passed her a note that said, would you please refrain from laughter? And she wrote back, I'm afraid I can't, and went on laughing, which I thought, oh, more power to her. I couldn't have done that. If someone passed me a note, I would have been very inhibited. So I think those are the two extremes, say, Austin, Texas, and London, England. And I enjoy that, you know. I enjoy experiencing the different audiences because it always shapes and makes the monologue different and fresh and interesting. It's a sociological event then. I'm learning about the place I'm in through telling a story about the place I came from.
Speaking of Swimming to Cambodia, has that been dubbed in any foreign languages yet, or is it only available in English?
It's been translated in book form. As far as the film goes, no, I don't think that's been dubbed. I think that would be wonderful, but impossible because of the speed that I speak. And in Russia, I tell about this in my monologue, Monster in a Box. In Russia, they tried to do a simultaneous translation at the Russian Film Festival that I went to some years back with Swimming to Cambodia. And I start out like this. In 1986, I met this incredible director, Roland Jaffe, a very intense man, a combination of Jesus, Zorro, and Rasputin. Heart of Jesus, body of Zorro, eyes of Rasputin. And I'm doing it very fast. And then you hear the translation. It goes, one day he met an interesting director. You know, so what are you going to do? You know, all of the detail is gone, which I thrive on. You know, all the innuendo, the irony, the detail. So, but the books have been translated of my monologues, and they are in most of the Nordic, and Italy now has done it, but most of the Nordic countries. Germany has got Swimming to Cambodia, and Sweden, and Holland, and so I'm real happy about that.
When they shot Swimming to Cambodia, were they able to do it in many long, continuous takes, or did you have a lot of starting and stopping?
No. The idea was we must keep this flowing and no starting and stopping. And I said, I've got to do the whole monologue through three evenings for a live audience. So they had three 35mm cameras. Jonathan Demme was directing, and John Bailey was the cinematographer. They were excellent. And Carol Littleton was editing. Laurie Anderson was doing the music. We couldn't have had a better crew. And they had these three 35mm cameras going all the time, and they had assistants that were in stocking feet changing the reels, you know, so that one camera could be going and then the other would be loaded. And then we'd do maybe one afternoon of pickup shots. And that was it. We did it in 3 days, and we did Monster in a Box that Nick Broomfield directed in London at the Riverside Studios the same way. Now, one of the interesting things was I am so used to relating to an audience that I don't want to leave them out. I was looking past the camera to the audience. The cameras were annoyance, and I was apologizing to the audience because these were in the way. And Jonathan Demme's one note to me the last day, night we shot was, be generous to the camera. Aha! It was at that point that I realized that looking into the camera was looking into the eyes of the audience. Because, and of course, that's very powerful, because so few people look into a movie camera. I think Woody Allen is the only one that comes to mind that does an aside to a camera. So that time I looked into the camera and let the audience go, and it worked. We used most of that footage. So when I got to London, I knew we were doing Monster in a Box with Nick Broomfield. I said, I'd come out and apologize to the audience. That's how I let myself off the hook. I said, you're here to witness a filming of this monologue. I'm not going to be looking at you too much this evening. You're going to have to be the witnesses. I'm sorry. And so that let me off the hook, and I was able to pay attention to the camera. But I'm not a great fan of looking into a camera because it's a machine. I prefer a person's face. And now, recently, I've been working with John Borman in Malaysia on his new film. And I was playing a scene opposite Patricia Arquette. She's the star of the movie. And I had to say a line to her, and then she kind of, I said, come on, line, and she just kind of rejects me and walks away. And I have to turn and say, the bar, meaning that's the next place I'm going for a drink. I've been rejected. And every time I turn, I do it to the camera. And they had to do three takes. John Borman said, look over there, don't look at the camera. I just couldn't help, knowing that the audience is out there, I couldn't help relating and saying, you know, and then it takes, of course, you can't do that in a naturalistic film.
Not wanting to perhaps disrupt the process that may occur in the future relating to your John Borman film, what did you think of Malaysia?
I did not like Malaysia, and I was looking, I thought it was going to be an interesting experience. I was in Penang, and it was Chinese New Year, and the beaches were jammed with Chinese on these jet skis. Jellyfish were in, so they had jellyfish nets, but the jellyfish were getting through the nets, and the water was filled with fecal matter, and there were these black sea snakes. The one, you know, they come in, and one bit someone, and a guy reportedly died in 4 minutes, so I wasn't going. I was swimming in the pools, and the pool at our hotel was broken, so Penang was awful. But I'm going back in the middle of this tour to finish my scene in the jungle this time, where I give a lecture. I'm a Buddhist philosophy professor about a 50-foot Buddha, and they're building it in the jungles of Malaysia. And so I sort of look forward to that, but it's in the middle of my tour, and it's 22 hours there to shoot 2 days and 22 hours back. So you're 2 days shooting and 2 days on a plane. So that's kind of, you know, when I'm on the road, what wears me down is airports and planes and hotels are like sanctuaries for me. I mean, that's where I can rest. But for me, being in front of the audience is the great high. And the audiences on this tour have been sold out, superlative, wonderful. Standing room only, standing ovations. So that keeps me going. That's what the energy is that keeps me going.
Your wife, Renee, how has she felt through these years about being part of the subject matter of your mom?
She likes being a character because I think, first of all, Renee is a character. And she's also a very good writer, and she has a lot of lines that she contributes. She's never wanted to be seen. You know, she's around. She doesn't want to be seen. Like when we filmed Terrace of Pleasure for HBO, and she was in it, but just the back of her head. She said, I would like to remain, as an image, mysterious, but I would like to be a character in it. Of course, I run everything by her, and see, do you feel comfortable with this? In my new monologue, Grey's Anatomy, there's a whole section on her talking about wanting to get married, and me having cold feet, and she wrote that section, you know, so that was like a real piece of writing that she contributed.
Wow. That's great. Well, congratulations on getting married.
Finally. Thank you.
Finally, after 12 years?
Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. Sometimes those relationships turn out the best. A friend of mine wanted me to ask you, I said, if you could ask Pauline Gray one question, what would you ask? And she said, how do you get along with animals?
How do I get along with animals? I, as a kid, got along. I had Sex and Death at the age 14. My first monologue is about the love and death of pets and the trauma that I went through. And now I don't have a lot of a connection with them because I can't have them in New York because I'm on the road so much. And so when I'm around them, I get along with them. I'm trying to think the last animal involvement that I had. And I mean, this is a very good question. I think of animals. Here I am in Los Angeles. I haven't run into one. When I was in the Philippines, I did eat a big dish of dog, which I felt bad about, but it was the native dish, and I did give it a try. So whenever I tell people about that, they go, "What? You ate man's best friend?" But when I'm around them, I get along fine with them because it's a nonverbal experience, and I need some of that. I need to be around creatures that can't talk. Or I end up getting into a conversation, and it just gets me exhausted.
How do you feel now about being recognized on the street? Do people say,
aren't you Garrison Keillor? They do that. And it goes from this. Don't you live next door to me? Didn't I meet you somewhere before? Aren't you Spalding Gray? Where have I seen you before? And then judging from who they are, I kind of feel it out. Like, if I'll say, well, you may have seen me in Bette Midler's film Beaches. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Or Swimming to Cambodia. Now, there was a man that I went out yesterday for the first time in Los Angeles. I haven't been out of this tower. And this man stopped me and he said, Grey's Anatomy. I said, that's right. Did you see it? No, I didn't see it. But I think it's a great concept because I'm a medical illustrator. And I love that book, Grey's Anatomy. And I think you're very unique. And he gave me this big line. And here's a guy that didn't even see my monologue. And he's talking to me in a 7-Eleven about how wonderful he thinks I am. So it's very odd. It goes, in other words, what I have is a horizontal celebrity, which is very difficult to maintain in this culture. You know, Whoopi Goldberg started off with a one-woman show, and she went vertical, straight up, got to be a star. I've been comfortable with my level of celebrity because I can go out on the street and be partially recognized. I mean, Dustin Hoffman goes out on the street, he'd have to wear sunglasses, you know, or a disguise, or Woody Allen puts a hat on. I don't have to do that, and that allows me to gather new material because everyone's not coming at me. I can see out. I can look out with my good eye. See, I've lost my sight in my left eye, and I have good sight in my right. And I got very depressed about that. The monologue is about that, Grey's Anatomy. Although it's a very funny and humorous monologue, it was a traumatic topic. And then I heard this story recently about a famous mask of an Eskimo storyteller. And this Eskimo storyteller is blind in one eye and sees well in the other. And they said that was a symbol that with the blind eye, he's looking inward. So he's being subjective and seeing his inside mind, and out, and with his good eye, he's seeing the outside world. And there's that balance, and I see that is what I try to do in my work, that I'm matching my psyche, my neurosis, my internal states of mind with the way that I perceive the world, so that I would never talk about something that I didn't experience without going through that experience, and then I filter it, I refer to myself as a poetic journalist in that way, that I have an experience, but then I live with it for a while before I spit it out. And I keep a journal try to jog my memory and keep the details fresh. So I have piles of journals that before I do a new monologue, I start going through them and reading them and saying, well, what's this new monologue about? Because I never know if there's a new monologue. I didn't know I was going to do one about this, and I don't know what the next one is about. I hope there is one. I'm up to number 14, and I'll be 53 in June, so I will have made it through the Bermuda Triangle of Health, as I talk about in Grey's Anatomy, between 50 and 53 when everything falls apart. If I make it to 53, I'm home free.
I noticed in your press material that you require a warm-up room to vocalize.
Yeah, I worked on vocal exercises since 1970 when I joined Richard Schechner's performance group and then co-founded the Worcester Group. We did group theater and we had vocal coach. And it was very important that we did diaphragmatic breathing, which I do, and then articulation exercises like beboo 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 or lily 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 lily, just to get lips tongue warmed up so that when I go out, I'm very precise and it's like an opera singer, you know, in the sense of precise articulation and the right rhythms. So I really consider what I'm doing, the finished product, as music. Lyrical. It has a very lyrical quality to it. So I spend a half hour alone in the dressing room. I come in, I have a cup of tea, caffeinated tea, Earl Grey, whatever. And then I'll lie down and on the floor and begin panting with my diaphragm just to exercise it and then take it onto a sound. And I'll do 15 minutes of voice, and that's very centering. And then I'll go on.
Great. My last question to you, because my time is up. Boxers or briefs?
Briefs. How did you know about boxers or briefs? The story is interesting.
Clinton thing that just happened a couple of days ago, where he was talking with a bunch of high school students and they could ask him any question, and the one teenage girl said, "Do you wear boxers or briefs?"
How wonderful. I didn't know about that. When I was in Australia in 1986, I was taking questions from the audience, and someone said to me, "What do you feel about Reagan, President Reagan?" And I said, "I don't know anything more about him than you. Ask me something more personal." So a guy stands up and says, "The other day you came into the men's room and we were all standing at the urinal and you decided to go into this private toilet booth. And why didn't you stand with us?" I said, "That's a good question. That's a good question. You know how sometimes you walk into a men's room and you just don't want to line up with the rest of the guys? But it's funny you should ask, Boxers of Briefs, because I was just in Stowe, Vermont, skiing, and I went into one of these pools and jacuzzis. It was a spa at a hotel. And I looked around, and here I'd come from New England, and there were 20 men there, and they all had boxer shorts on, boxer bathing shorts. And I had my ocean briefs. And they were looking at me like they were going to throw me out of this place. And I thought, my God, I've really graduated from New England. I'm wearing briefs, and they feel great because you can feel your legs when you're swimming. Then someone ended up stealing my ocean briefs in Stowe, Vermont. And so I went to the store in the hotel where the pool was, and I said, "Do you have any briefs?" "No, we don't sell those here. The men feel they're too revealing. We only have boxers." So I bought this $30 boxer bathing suit, and it was like swimming in a tent. The thing would bubble up, it would in the water, you know. And I thought, that reminded me when I was 15 years old. And the kids that wore briefs were from the other side of the tracks. They were really dirty guys. But that's a great question, because I hadn't even heard that Clinton was asked that. So he does the briefs, right? Yeah. He wears underwear is something. I mean, some people don't even do that.
Yeah. No, he said briefs in the thing. Spalding, thank you.
Is this enough? For you?
Oh, yeah.
Fine.
Fantastic.
What did you add it down to?
Oh, probably about 13 to 15 minutes, right. You know.
Right.
But, you know, it all depends, you know. That was so special, you know, I may even cut out one of the other segments and only do four this time.
Because, great. You know, I think it's a very good, nice mix, this interview, and fresh. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on it that's fresh.
Good.